Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. A lot happened in the last 36 to 48 hours in Washington, here in the state of Georgia. Producer Tom Faust and I had a list of, I bet 35 topics that we thought were relevant to discuss. We've whittled it down. Don't worry. We've got the key ones for you today on Political Rewind to talk about with our panel. Before we introduce them and get into the show proper, a couple of quick program notes. First of all, and we'll discuss this in more detail in a couple of minutes, Governor Deal gives his final State of the State address tomorrow at 11 a.m. in the House chamber at the Capitol. And we're going to go downtown and do the show at 2 o'clock live. We'll preempt my other show, Two-Way Street. Greg Bluestein, who is here today, will be with us tomorrow. Jim Galloway will join us. Lieutenant Governor Cagle will come in and talk about what the governor had to say. So will Speaker Ralston and assorted other members of the legislature to talk about that. And then the other quick program note, again, 2 o'clock tomorrow in place of Two-Way Street. The other note, we've told you this a few times, but it's upon us now. Starting Friday, day after tomorrow, Political Rewind will move from 3 o'clock to 2 o'clock. We're going to go into the time slot of Science Fridays, which will move to 3, but we thought it was about time we had a consistent starting time across the week. So day after tomorrow, please tune in an hour early. We hope you make the move with us. All right, Greg Bluestein, I said you are here. You are the lead political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We're glad to have you here today. And you were at the Eggs and Issues breakfast, and we want to talk about some of the news that came out of there. But thanks for coming in.
No problem. Love being here.
Dr. Andre Gillespie, a professor of political science at Emory University. We haven't seen you in the new year. Happy New Year,
Happy
Dr.
New year
Gillespie.
To you.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Chip Lake. Republican strategist. It's been a while, too, since we've seen you. So
indeed.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy
Jim.
New Year to you. Good to be back.
All right. So the Eggs and Issues breakfast this morning, Greg. First of all, make sure everybody in our audience knows what the Eggs and Issues breakfast is.
Yeah, it's an annual event sponsored by the Georgia Chamber of Commerce that's sort of used as by politicians to unveil some of their biggest business-friendly initiatives. It's usually the second day of the legislative session, but because of the big Georgia-Alabama game on Monday, they pushed it to the third day. So this morning we heard from House Speaker David Ralston, Governor Deal, Lieutenant Governor Cagle about some of their biggest initiatives for the year.
The governor made some news.
He did. He basically said that Amazon incentives are off the table for this session. He said that if Amazon makes Georgia one of its top three finalists. If Amazon puts out a shortlist and Georgia is one of the top contenders, then he will call lawmakers back for a special session that will be devoted entirely to incentives for Amazon. And by the way, this is a $5 billion, 50,000 job deal, so it will probably require as much or even at least $1 billion in incentives and capital improvement projects and others. So this will be a tough vote for lawmakers from both parties talking about, you know, huge incentives for a project for a company that is already making money hand over fist.
You asked him a question about why a special section in a brief news conference after he gave his speech. Let's listen to what he told you.
Because we don't know what the needs are going to be. And I think it would be premature for us to attempt to guess that. If we shoot too low, then we could be in trouble there and have to call a special session to correct what we might have done during the regular session. I think it is better for us, as I said in the speech a while ago, to focus on the issues that have already made us an attractive state for Amazon to come to, improve those in every way that we can, and then if we do find out, and hopefully we will, and I think we will, that we will be on the short list of prospective states for them to locate their second headquarters in, then at that time it would be more appropriate for us to have a tailored session, a special session of the General Assembly, in order to focus directly on the kind of incentives, for example, that will be necessary to accommodate a magnitude of growth that this particular company will bring with it.
Okay, so Andre and Chip, I get what the governor's saying. He's saying, let's not put the cart before the horse. Let's see what happens, what Amazon is looking for. At the same time, it seems to me, Andre, Greg also said something that's meaningful. They want to get this session right now with all of its problems out of the way so they can go off and run for re-election. They got a big budget to pass. So they're going to have to, they're going to defer it in a special session. Nevertheless, would you really want to complicate the current session by also asking these guys to take up a billion-dollar incentive package?
I mean, I could see how Amazon could suck all the energy and all the oxygen out of the room, and I think that that's probably more of what Governor Deal is thinking about there. You know, I'm also sort of going through my head strategically whether or not that would necessarily be the right move. Are you sending the wrong signal to Amazon and saying that, like, we're not going to even think about ways to sweeten our position by being proactive about doing things now? And the analogy that's coming to mind for me was when I was an assistant professor thinking about that first book and whether or not you turn in the whole manuscript or whether you tried to get a contract on a chapter. And I remembered my editors suggesting that, no, you should wait for the full manuscript, because if you send a chapter and all the reviews come back and they say stuff like, well, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this, so no, and you were planning on doing all that other stuff, then you would have been too soon. So I just will have to wait and see whether or not that was a wise decision.
Yeah, I kind of took a little bit different take on it when I heard it this morning. If the governor said we're going to call people back for a special session, I think that shows a level of commitment. But as Amazon's looking at it, saying, well, the governor of Georgia is willing to call his legislature back into session, there's also the benefit, which you mentioned, Bill, of the fact that this can't be used per se as horse trading during this session for any budget vote here or there or any sweetener here and there. It's going to be tackled on its own in a special session. And I think it's important to note, too, that I think there were over 200 applicants for this 238 for this, for this HQ2. So probably pretty good chance we will be on the short list, but you don't want to go through all of this process and then find out that you're not.
Yeah, and state officials are very confident that we will be, that Georgia will be on the short list. But this also is a level of protection for a lot of politicians who might face primary challenges in May. I guess the thinking is, why vote on this if, for the off chance that we're not a finalist, why take this risky vote? Remember, just not too long ago, lawmakers punted the decision about spending public money on Mercedes-Benz Stadium to the city of Atlanta because they didn't want that vote on their record.
That's a really good point. That most of the elections that legislators will face presumably will come in primary challenges rather than general election fights. Is that basically right? I'm not even sure there's going to be primary challenges out there.
I think Democrats are newly emboldened. I think there's going to be a lot. We saw it, in the special elections in November. There's going to be a lot of Democratic challengers for every race on the ticket. I think maybe not all of them. But this is a risky vote for Republicans and Democrats. Republicans who don't want to be branded as giving corporate giveaways to Fortune 500 companies. And Democrats have their own issues. And in the mayor's race, this came up. Former State Senator Vincent Fort said that Democrats shouldn't be spending, the city shouldn't be spending money on Amazon. They should be spending money on education and infrastructure spending and not on some giant company.
Well, and the reality is, too, most of the people running for statewide office have already resigned before session. Some of them have chosen to stay in session. Michael Williams, for example, is candidate for governor. I suspect he's going to be very active this session trying to get press. And if this special session happens, I don't have a crystal ball to know when it might happen, but if it happens in June or July, you're looking at a time frame then it is after the primary, probably right before the runoff. And I think there's probably a high degree of likelihood at that point that Michael Williams' candidacy for governor might be concluded and over. And so at that point in time, even if he still is a sitting state senator, how much energy is he able to capture to oppose something like this?
Regardless of the timing, Andra, if Amazon puts Atlanta on the list of contenders moving forward, Governor Deal today, the big headline is he said it will be the biggest incentive package in state history to lure Amazon here. So we'll watch how that unfolds. Greg, the other thing that I was struck by today, and I wasn't at the Eggs and Issues breakfast, so I don't know. You can tell me.
You missed some good eggs.
I don't know if he said this directly himself, but I know it was reported out in at least news releases that his office put out. He made it clear there ain't nothing lame about this duck. He plans to have a very active agenda to try to seal his legacy, but there's more to it than that. His office also warned would-be contenders for his office that if they think one way to run on his to run for the office is to trash Nathan Deal's record, they better watch out, because he's not a lame duck. They'll come after him with guns a-blazing.
Yeah, it was uncharacteristic of the governor, to be honest. It wasn't part of his
It sounded like a Chris Riley kind
of. It sounded like a Chris Riley edition. Yeah. I was told it wasn't, by the way. I was told it was from a speechwriter.
His chief of staff.
Yeah, but this it wasn't part of his scripted remarks, but at the end he said, my senior staff is very territorial, and they will come after you. So he basically said, it was very much like what Mayor Kasim Reed did doing his his sort of lame duck tenure, was say, if you're going to go after my legacy, I'm going to go right back after you. That's what Governor Deal said. And I think it was definitely a shot at the Michael Williamses of the world who have criticized him left and right.
Andre, another thing that we learned today, it did not come up in the we did learn something again in the Eggs and Issues breakfast that's a headline that we ought to talk about before we go to the next thing that I was thinking about. Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle is now saying that the adoption bill, which caused so much controversy at the end of last session when senators decided they wanted to put in a provision, the bill attempts to make it easier for children to be adopted in the state because of the huge number of foster families we have, because these kids can't get adopted easily enough. And members of the Senate added an amendment that would prohibit gay and lesbian couples from adopting. It took the bill down last session. It was almost certain to come back. But today, Casey Cagle said, I want a clean bill without that amendment. That's a big deal this early in the session.
Well, it's a big deal because Republican gubernatorial candidates have taken very conservative stances on kind of marriage and family issues in order to try to appeal to their base. So the fact that Cagle is deviating from that is notable. But there's also a constitutional issue here. So especially when you're dealing with married couples, and married couples have the right to adopt, and that's going to be true regardless of the composition of those couples, like, that's just asking for a Supreme Court case, because there's no way that you can deny legally married couples the right to adopt when other married couples have the right to be able to do that.
Chip, does this suggest that in a larger context, in terms of other issues throughout this session, most specifically a new attempt to pass a religious liberty bill, does this in some ways hint that the lieutenant governor is joining with Speaker Ralston and the governor in warning we don't want that issue coming to the floor this year? It doesn't do us any good? Or should this be seen only in the context of the adoption bill?
Well, I think it can be seen through both, but I think if you're the lieutenant governor, you want to gavel in and gavel out of session as soon as you can. Look, the way that bill ended at the end of last session left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth, and the speaker made it very clear nothing will move over in this chamber until this adoption bill moves. And so I'm not surprised they came to a consensus on it. It's worth debating religious liberty, but not to the point that it's going to take down this bill to help so many kids in Georgia.
And real quick, this doesn't mean this issue doesn't go to the floor. It just means that, and Cagle said it today, Lieutenant Governor Cagle said it today, they will pass the comprehensive adoption bill without this language, but there'll be a separate bill with this language that will still probably reach a Senate vote in some form or capacity. So Senate lawmakers will still probably have the chance to vote on this. It just won't be the bill that the House will ever take up.
And I think it's important to point out here that while Amazon is off the table for the main session, Amazon is implicated in this. And so I think that that's also an important signal to Amazon.
Amazon
as well.
Is everywhere hovering over this session.
They are the computing cloud that's clouding over this entire session.
Another issue that wasn't part of the Eggs and Issues breakfast this morning, but I think is worth talking about, and Andra, because you work on a university campus, I'd really love to hear your thoughts on this. We've learned today that a bill that Representative Earl Earhart worked hard on last year on the House side, which would take away from colleges and universities in this state as much power as they've had in the past to investigate and take disciplinary action in cases of campus rapes, other sexual assaults, and put it in the hands of law enforcement. That bill it was controversial last year, but we now have learned the Senate plans to take it up. What's the implication of that?
Well, I think it'll be really interesting to see what the deliberation about this bill looks like in the era of Me Too and Time's Up. And I think the hard part about this is that schools want the autonomy to be able to handle this through their judiciary process in a way that is supposed to or is intended to help both the victim and the accused in this situation and do due process. But the issues that Earl Earhart raises on the surface are about whether or not due process is followed by schools, because there's certainly a bad history of colleges and universities, you know, pushing some of these issues under the table, in certain instances to the detriment of victims in these situations. But the problem is always going to be whether or not colleges and universities and college and university spaces are different spaces where different kinds of considerations need to kind of be applied in this situation, and whether or not you want to clog the sort of normal justice system with lots of cases, you know, some of which may have merit and some of which may not have merit.
Greg, do I remember this correctly, that one of the things that people were concerned about with Earhart was his suggestion that in some cases, the way universities were investigating these cases, it was the alleged perpetrator who he felt wasn't getting fair treatment. Have I got that right?
You do. And he's highlighted a few cases of what he calls abuse of powers. And the AJC has written lengthy, and other media have also written lengthy stories about, there's a few really shocking cases out there. But what the critics of this legislation says is, don't take one or two isolated incidents and make it a broad prescription for the higher education
system. And that, to me, Chip, makes what Andra said about watching how this develops in the Me Too era particularly relevant. If, in fact, that we continue a discussion about the fact that possible perpetrators aren't being treated fairly, that's going to sit poorly with the people who are very worried about women's protection.
It is, and I've not spoken to Earl about this bill, but this could be an exercise, knowing that it's not something that is likely to get the requisite votes in the House and the Senate and be in front of the governor's desk. It could be an exercise that Earl is going through to say, hey, guys, there is a legislative vehicle. If some of these universities and colleges in this state don't start doing a better job at due process, and I'm not casting any judgment on which ones are and aren't, et cetera, but there is a legislative solution to this, or at least he's proposed a legislative solution. So I think, you know, a byproduct of that is he's hoping, and I think we've seen, you know, I think he's been pretty happy with what a few of them have done as far as making sure there are safeguards in there for everybody in this type of situation.
I mean, and it also sometimes discounts the fact that, you know, not every campus police agency is an actual police agency, but a lot of them are. And a lot of them are involved, and they actually are doing their job. So it just kind of raises the question of whether or not this is necessary. And I think from the victims' perspectives, you know, I have heard students talk about cases where alleged perpetrators are still running around campuses, and just the sight of them is distressing to their victims, or their alleged victims in this case. And so I have to admit, I'm not particularly, you know, while I want to be sure that due process is followed, and I know that, you know, not every case, you know, is a slam dunk, and that there, you know, and that stuff happens sometimes, and sometimes people are falsely accused of things, but. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there's necessarily the rampant problem of people being falsely accused of things. And when you see people who have been traumatized sort of react in ways that look credible, then it, you know, it makes you take a different stance.
I've got to get a break in. As we go to break, we're not going to talk about this today, but I want to put it out there because it's an item that we'll discuss as the session unfolds. Another thing that Governor Deal highlighted in his Eggs and Issues speech, and I'm sure almost certain we'll hear it tomorrow in the State of the State address, is he wants to expand rural broadband. It's a goal they've had for a long time. He's already done some of that during his tenure as governor. But the reason it's complicated now and will be really worthy of conversation is that, Greg, as your colleague Jim Galloway wrote this morning, with net neutrality being upturned by the Federal Communications Commission, there is less incentive for big broadband companies to want to go into areas that don't have the money to support them. So just to put it on the radar, we will be talking about that as this session unfolds. Look, well, let's get our first break of the show out of the way. When we come back, a lot more on Political Rewind.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB1-CAR or donate online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Chip Lake, Andra Gillespie, Greg Bluestein are with us here today. By the way, I didn't mention the most one of the things that we care about here at GPB when I mentioned the State of the State address. The governor speaks at 11. If you want to listen to him deliver that speech, we're going to carry it live here on GPB radio across the state. You could also watch it on the GPB.org website if you really can't, if you want to see the governor. We want to give you the chance to see him give that speech. And then tomorrow night at 7 o'clock on Lawmakers on GPB TV, they'll broadcast the whole speech. For those of you who are in your offices all day tomorrow thinking, oh my gosh, I missed that State of the State speech. I've got to get home to watch it. All right, let's move on. Greg, a huge case with enormous repercussions in North Carolina. A federal panel, a three-judge panel, has ruled that North Carolina's congressional redistricting was so egregiously partisan, drawn so egregiously to give Republicans all of the seats they could muster, that it's unconstitutional, needs to be thrown out. The court gave North Carolina legislators 2 weeks to come up with a new map, or they said they might draw it themselves.
And they're meeting this week to start working on that.
The potential impact of this ruling, along with what's happening with the U.S. Supreme Court, looking at the Wisconsin gerrymandering case, and Maryland, too, where in Maryland it's Democrats who drew a map that favored them. In Wisconsin and North Carolina, it's Republicans. This could throw the entire 2018 election cycle into a whole new world.
Yeah, and this was the first time that a federal court had blocked a congressional map because of a partisan gerrymander. That's why this was so significant. And there was a few Georgia lawyers involved in this case from Bondurant, Mixon, and Elmore, the law firm here in Atlanta, that included Jason Carter, the 2014 Democratic nominee for governor. I asked them, the folks at Bondurant, what implications this had for Georgia. They cited a 1964 case, a Supreme Court case involving Georgia, that struck down Georgia's congressional districts and announced the simple but hugely important principle: one vote, one person's vote in a federal election should be worth as much as another's, is what they said. Yesterday, for the first time in history, a federal court applied that same principle to North Carolina's General Assembly. They say basically that that principle should and would be used in court to force other law legislatures like Georgia's to use those same principles to guide them in drawing districts.
So, I mean, this is a sort of a test of sort of, you know, what are the limits of what you can get away with. And so, I mean, I think this panel in particular is doing this knowing that there's a Supreme Court case that's coming up and then seeing, you know, how far this case is actually, you know, going to make its way through. You know, the thing in talking to friends who work in this space that I think it's hard for judges to kind of conceptualize is how do you prove that there is a disproportionate impact on drawing lines from a partisan standpoint in a particular way. And they can't seem to agree on what the proper formula is. And when they do propose formulas, oftentimes social scientists or mathematicians will look at them and be like, "Though that's a crazy way to sort of determine
I think
that.
What you just said is so significant. Now, in individual cases, in a case-by-case basis, this three-judge panel was able to look at quotes from North Carolina Republicans who essentially all said, they brought in a consultant that said, draw as many Republican districts as you, seats as you can. In an individual case, you might be able to make those kinds of arguments that it was clearly done for partisan purposes. But Chief Justice Roberts has said of this issue, despite the fact they'll take it up, how do we put ourselves in a position of calling balls and strikes, sometimes for Democrats, sometimes for Republicans? Does the United States Supreme Court want to be in that position? he may be wrong that that's not their role, but on the other hand, it certainly complicates this.
Oh, it complicates it enormously. I mean, the reality is, I don't know how you take the politics out of redistricting. And what Greg had just read from Jason Carter's firm is an equal protection argument. It's the same argument that was made in Wisconsin. The Supreme Court's already heard that case, and they're waiting to comment on it. But there has been no case law to say that it is unconstitutional to politically gerrymander districts. What they have said is you cannot use race as a factor in drawing maps. And so that's why Justice Roberts said what he said, because if we go into the census, which we're about to go into, and in 4 years from now, gosh, 3.5 years from now, we'll be drawing maps. If you're not allowed to draw maps using race and you're not allowed to have politics into the equation, then what guidelines are they going to give Republican legislatures? It doesn't matter what party you are. What guidelines are they going to give legislators as they go about drawing maps and redistricting?
Well, I think it makes a strong case for nonpartisan redistricting. What
is nonpartisan?
Having judges draw it is
but, right, because judges are not partisan, right?
Well, I mean, it's a question of taking it out of the hands of legislators, because
sure.
That's kind of like letting the fox in the hen house. Of course, they're going to draw lines to favor themselves potentially if they're thinking about running for office in the future, or other kinds of things. So if you put it in the hands of a bipartisan commission that's actually split, or you put it in the hands of a citizen commission that's made up of appointees that are appointed by, you know, a wide variety of folks so that everybody kind of has their hand in the game, and where you're thinking about issues like geographic contiguity, thinking about sort of things that actually make sense together. So like, do you have, I mean, there are ways where this could make sense. Big rural district and pocket of an urban district that like doesn't make sense in terms of this legislator now having to represent like these very disparate kind of constituencies together. All of those things I think would probably look a little bit better.
I don't disagree that might be where we're heading. If we head in that direction, I'm not advocating for it or against it, but wouldn't there be the same legal claim to equal protection if somebody looked at a map and said, you know, I believe that I can make a case that this was drawn on partisan lines and here's why. I can make a case, and certainly you can make a case too. I mean, I would assume if those independent commissions do draw lines, they would have to draw lines consistent with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is still new. Section 5 has been kicked. So this is a complicated issue. There's no easy answer to it.
Let me move forward on this very issue, Greg. First of all, clearly the state of North Carolina, the legislature, is likely to try to to get a stay to keep this from going into effect. But if this ruling stands, in a congressional election, which we expect in 2018, could determine the control of Congress, if North Carolina has to draw a map that represents the people in a more bipartisan way, it could have a big impact on whether that the House goes Democratic in the fall.
Yeah, what's the makeup there? I think it's
10-3. Yeah,
And the different maps I've seen show it could be much closer, 7,
sure.
6.
Oh, yeah.
Depending on how those draw. Like some of those districts are just skirting the city of Charlotte altogether. This is why all three of these cases, the one in Maryland and Wisconsin as well, are so closely watched.
The other thing, Andre, before we change subjects, that I always feel like we really need to talk about when we talk about redistricting, gerrymandering, is this isn't just a matter of how many Republicans or Democrats you have in a congressional delegation. This is what contributes to the poisonous partisan gridlock on Capitol Hill. If you represent a district that you are safe in because it's been drawn so that 70% of the district is Republican, you never have to listen to a single proposal that a Democrat makes about anything, and vice versa in Democratic states. Gerrymandering has a poisonous impact on the entire system.
So let me sort of provide a bunch of caveats to that. Are arguments, sort of amongst academics that if we look at newer data, that there is increasing evidence to suggest that gerrymandering contributes to polarization. A slightly older literature, about a decade and a half old, points to what we would call ideological sorting as part of the reason that we have polarization. And so, you know, it's less about the district lines and more about the fact that there aren't as many liberal Republicans or conservative Democrats anymore. And so where our parties used to be ideologically more diverse and have bigger tents and people had to figure out how to work together, we've seen people shift to their camps, particularly whites. So we see this less so amongst minority populations because those are all kind of overwhelmingly Democratic. But you see this happening, and then that's also disincentivizing people. I think there are other things to talk about. You know, we'll probably talk about this a little bit later, but when President Trump started, you know, started talking about earmarks and other kinds of old-fashioned things that used to kind of grease the wheels of progress, not in the ways that he thinks, but like, you know, but that people could talk about. People would talk about lobbying reform. There are other ways that people used to learn how to get along with one another and get to know one another so they could work together, and that those are also actually contributing to people not working together well anymore.
All right. I'm glad you mentioned earmarks. President Trump had a remarkable meeting. As he seemed to want to describe it, he did a remarkable TV show yesterday for about 55 minutes from the White House cabinet room. The reporters, just brief setup, were invited into the room for what is typically a spray. It's a photo op, and maybe the president gets a couple of shouted questions. He makes some news by saying something off the top of his head. Yesterday, he let them stay, the cameras, in for 55 minutes. It was on live television, CNN, MSNBC, everybody covered it, to the president's delight. Now, we can talk about why the president did that, but at the same time, let's talk about the impact of some of what he said. For instance, this was a meeting, presumably, to talk about how they were going to deal with immigration issues, the wall that Trump wants to spend $18 billion building, finding a solution for the Dreamers, DACA kids, and young adults who are in this country and protected under Obama guidelines. And it was Democrats and Republicans. So why don't you listen just a little bit of the conversation back and forth. First, you're going to hear the proposal, the Democratic proposal. Why don't we just do a clean DACA bill? Let's put the wall to the side. And then listen as Kevin McCarthy, the Republican majority leader, jumps in after President Trump seems to give away the store on DACA.
What about a clean DACA bill now?
I have no problem. I think that's basically what Dick is saying. We're going to come up with DACA. We're going to do DACA. And then we can start immediately on the phase two, which would be comprehensive.
Would you be agreeable to that?
Yeah, I would like to. But I think we have to do DACA first.
Mr. President, you need to be clear, though. I think what Senator Feinstein's asking here, when we talk about just DACA, we don't want to be back here 2 years later. You have to have security, as the secretary would tell you.
But I think that's what she's saying.
No, I think she's saying something different.
I think you're saying DACA without security.
First voice, Dianne Feinstein, the Democratic senator from San Francisco. Greg, you know, that one of the reasons we are told, allegedly, that the president decided to allow this to be televised was to combat all the rumor, all the talk that he's not fit, he doesn't know how to run the office. Yesterday he did, as I said, just about give away the store for a couple minutes there.
Yeah, Senator Dick Durbin said his head was still spinning after that meeting because it was so remarkable. But you heard him not really play in that short clip, but throughout the meeting, not really play up the importance of the security wall that he made as the backbone of his
That's because the Mexicans are going to pay for it.
They're going to pay
for it. Yeah, if that happens, I'm assuming it's going to be through some type of trade thing that, you know, we'll get a tariff that will help pay for the wall.
Sure.
And so it was interesting to watch him kind of backtrack and equivocate, because I wish that had happened during the campaign, because I think everybody knew Mexico wasn't going to pay for a wall. And I think everybody knew that you weren't going to have a 2,000-mile wall on the border. And so it would have at least been nice to have acknowledged and conceded that.
So it was kind of, you know, those of us who follow politics thought it was sort of interesting to watch it unfold. Conservative Republicans didn't think it was interesting at all. They're furious today because they think that the president essentially was willing to endorse a renewal of DACA without demanding border protections. But even beyond that, Chip, we're facing the potential for a government shutdown in a week or so. All of this is part of the bargaining that's going on. And the, among other things, the president just threw the whole thing into confusion. What is, where do they stand? Where do Republicans go now?
He has been all over the board on this issue. And I think he's about to find out. And he probably found out yesterday that this is not an issue that you want to be all over the board on. But it'll be, look, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because this might be, it might be. We'll have to wait to see how it plays out. But this could be the one issue where it benefits him to have ran as a candidate essentially against both parties in Washington. I don't know how it'll turn out, but it's complicated, and I think he probably realized.
And what was really
yesterday.
Interesting to me was his use of the word, and he said it a few times, comprehensive immigration.
Absolutely.
That's a bad word for a lot of Republicans.
Yeah, George W. Bush learned that you've got to be careful about that
word. But it
shows
you're thoughtful, and you're smart.
Lindsey Graham has been one of the few Republican senators who've used that word as well, and when he said we need a comprehensive immigration, Trump said, basically, I'll take the heat. I will fight for this, and I'll fight for a pathway to citizenship. Another bad phrase for many Republicans that Trump embraced yesterday.
So another moment that was intriguing, and Andrew, you've already alluded to it, was President Trump saying, it's too hard to get things done up here. You're fighting all the time. You can't come to agreements. Maybe if we had earmarks back, maybe that'd help things out a lot. Of course, I don't want to be overly basic about this, simplistic earmarks, of course, when members of Congress get particular funding requests made for projects in their own district. What was so funny about that, Chip, is the president obviously forgot about things like, the Alaskan Bridge to Nowhere, the North Carolina Teapot Museum, a $500,000 gift to the people of the town in North Carolina that wanted to build the museum. Mm-hmm. I mean, earmarks have never been a favorite of conservative Republicans, that's for sure.
No, look.
Except if it's in their own district.
That's right. Depends on how senior they are up there. But look, there can be a strong policy argument on bringing back earmarks from the transparency perspective. You will never win that argument with voters. Never. And I don't see it happening.
You know, one of the things that was actually, there were two things that were interesting about the earmarks when President Trump lamented that stuff happens slowly. And he's like, stuff happens too slow around here. It was like, yes, by design. That's what the framers wanted. And it was in part so that people didn't make rash decisions that could have, immediate, spectacularly bad impacts on people. But then when he starts talking about sort of ways to kind of grease the wheels a little bit, I understood. I was sympathetic to it. I remember having a conversation with my former congressman back in Virginia, who said, back before the lobbying limits, we got to go on junkets together. That's how we got to know one another. Yeah. I think sometimes that there are some features of the old system that were abused and, you were eliminated for legitimate reasons, that sometimes if you could take the good parts of what was eliminated at first, that might actually help things. But I actually think it's a good thing that things happen slowly and that they're supposed to deliberate and that you're trying to find as much consensus as possible, because these issues are serious. And so that's why being rash and doing things quickly is not always the best thing in the world.
Greg, regardless of what many people out in the world today, in the political world, in the media, might have thought about yesterday's television show, President Trump didn't have any doubts about how it went. He had another spray this afternoon. He had a cabinet meeting. They were in the same room. He welcomed in the media, and here's what he said about yesterday.
Got great reviews by everybody other than two networks who were phenomenal for about 2 hours. Then after that, they were called by their bosses to say, wait a minute. And unfortunately, a lot of those anchors sent us letters saying that was one of the greatest meetings they've ever witnessed. And they were great. For about 2 hours, they were phenomenal. And then they went a little bit south on us, but not that bad. It was fun. They probably wished they didn't send us those letters of congratulations, but it was good. I'm sure their ratings were fantastic. They always are.
Boy, Andrew, you know, when I write letters of congratulations to presidents, it takes them longer than 24 hours to get them. I'm amazed at the fact the anchors got them out there that fast.
Right. I heard Wolf Blitzer talking to Mark Short yesterday, sort of after that, thanking them for opening it up. And I have to admit, it was actually a pretty cool thing to watch. So I watched it on C-SPAN last night, and it was fascinating to watch. It was also fascinating to watch the Democrats and the Republicans and their scrums afterwards talk past each other. Mm-hmm. And it was like, yeah, y'all didn't resolve anything. So that's going to be really fun. I like being able to see it. And so it was really nice to have that conversation. On the other hand, that was symbolic. That wasn't actually where the real deliberation was going to take place. And I think people need to watch it with a grain of salt. And every time President Trump does stuff like that, one, it confirms that he's good at the parts of being president that are televised that he's seen before. And I couldn't help but think as I watched this, oh, this is like a more sedate version of the boardroom on The Apprentice. So, and that's why it worked for him. But there are limits to how far that's actually going to take you when it comes to government.
All I can say is the West Wing met The Apprentice yesterday in the White House.
I kind of agree with Andra. It's very easy for us without thinking twice to sort of, you know, look askance at an awful lot of what President Trump does. But I think it's also true, Andra, that most of the real negotiations, it's kind of like covering the Capitol, Greg. You can sit in a committee room and hear negotiations going on, but we all know that's not where they're really taking place. But I didn't have any problem with the president opening that up to the media. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, we say it's not where the real negotiations take place, and that's probably right. But when you do something like that, it gives you really good insight. It gives you a front row seat into where the pressure points are, into body language, mm-hmm. how people are moving.
Absolutely.
When the president's
and Feinstein.
Talking. It absolutely
man,
does.
Feinstein. Yeah. Didn't hesitate for a second to try to take advantage of the press and the media being in there. Well, how about a clean bill, Ms. Yeah. All right, look, we got to take a break. There's more Trump news. We're going to talk a little bit. I hope we have some time about what Oprah Winfrey might be able to teach Democrats about running against Donald Trump. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air.
Sometimes I think I'm cursed because of something that happened before I was even born.
The Disney Pixar film Coco just won the Golden Globe for Best Animated Feature. It takes place in a small Mexican town on the Day of the Dead, the holiday to honor deceased loved ones. We'll talk with the co-writers and co-directors Lee Unkrich and Adrian Molina. Join us.
Fresh Air, 3 o'clock this afternoon here on GPB.
Greg Bluestein, over the last week we've had a series of incidents, news stories that have come out of Washington about the Russia investigation as it's unfolded on Capitol Hill. Last week, Republicans, Grassley and Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, decided to send their first criminal referral of this investigation to the FBI, and they chose Christopher Steele, the former British spy who created the dossier that's become so controversial. That really infuriated Democrats because they sent it off independent of any consultation with Democrats. So yesterday, Dianne Feinstein did something rather remarkable. She decided to release the entire transcript of the testimony of the head of Fusion GPS, who had hired Christopher Steele to investigate Russian ties to Trump. It was an unprecedented thing to do, but we learned some important information coming out of what Dianne Feinstein released.
Yeah, and the interview was a closed door committee meeting, and lately, Glenn Simpson, who is one of the people being interviewed, called for that transcript to be publicly aired. And Republican leaders of that committee said, basically, if you want it publicly aired, you have to do another sit-down interview, this time in a public setting. So Dianne Feinstein, who we just mentioned playing a key role in the immigration hearing, basically defied her Republican counterparts in the committee and published and released the entire transcript of these. It provided both sides of the issue some fresh ammunition for Democrats. There's some more details about that committee's that group's role in investigating Trump and connected potential ties with Russia. And for Republicans who look to criticize that firm's role, there's some revelations there as well.
Okay, so just a couple quick things. First of all, one of the things that was released in the testimony of Glenn Simpson suggested that the FBI already knew about a lot of the dossier materials because apparently they think there was a whistleblower for the FBI inside the Trump campaign. That's one of the interesting revelations. Second, apparently the FBI was already looking at the business dealings that Donald Trump had with the Russians. This wasn't inspired by some opposition research document put out by Fusion GPS. And it also contradicts Glenn Simpson, at least in his testimony, speaks to the integrity of Christopher Steele at a time when many Republicans are really trying to make him look as bad as possible. So those are just a few of the things that came out of this.
And nobody's going to change their mind about
anything.
No,
of course not.
I mean, it's just confirmation bias is at work here.
I think the message that Senator Feinstein sent, because I believe Senator Grassley and Senator Graham made a criminal referral to the FBI as part of this individual's testimony. I think the message she was trying to send is if you go and make criminal referrals to the FBI about witnesses that testify before this committee and you don't do it in a bipartisan manner and they want their testimony disclosed, I will disclose that testimony.
Well, and again, to elaborate on this, and especially what you just said, Andre, not only will this not change a single person's mind, this continues to, as much as possible, put us in a world where we obfuscate what might be factual material somewhere at the center of all this. It no longer matters whether it's true or not. It's how you spin it. And that, I think we have reason to be really disturbed about, no matter what side of the aisle you're on.
I would agree. And the one thing that I hope is that when cooler heads prevail about this, we can then go back and look at the record and actually take the record for what it's worth.
And by the way, a not insignificant sort of side note to this is that yesterday as well, Trump's personal lawyer sued BuzzFeed for publishing that Fusion GPS document outlining some of the issues. It's very scandalous, but some of the issues that they said they had uncovered about Trump
all right,
and his ties.
Quick note with you, Mr. Bluestein. First of all, our condolences on the University
Don't
of Georgia
remind me.
Loss. You were down there on the field with President Trump Monday night in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, covering him. So there's only one question to ask you, Greg. Was he flubbing the lyrics to the national anthem? How close were you to him?
I was on the sidelines, but I have to admit I wasn't watching his lips the entire time.
So much for the reporting, this event.
I'm just going to say what I looked at looking at the videotape, because confession didn't really turn until the third quarter. But when I was watching that, he looked like oftentimes the athletes that we criticize at the Olympics when they can't actually like mouth the words to the Star Spangled Banner at the same time. And I think that this was actually particularly important given the ways that he wrapped himself around himself with respect to sports. And so looking at athletes. And so one would think that either you keep your mouth shut and just look solemn the whole time, or you know all the words to the Star Spangled Banner. And I think I'm assuming everybody here in this room, we kind of had that one mastered by fifth grade.
Greg, what was it like to be out there with the president? Give us a quick report.
Yeah, well, I'm a diehard Georgia fan. So just the opportunity to go watch Georgia Alabama play, it was a great game up until the last 2 minutes. It was very unique having a president jump into that fray. I mean, there were people stuck in line for hours outside. There was tremendous traffic. It would have been bad either way. But the fact that you closed down one of the four gates for the president's entrance, and the fact that he left in the second quarter. Sure made it easier for me to watch the game, because once he was gone, I suddenly had a lot less to do.
One of the things I will say is I know people complained about being stuck outside and it was cold and it was wet, and I understand, but anytime the president shows up someplace, you have to pack your patience and expect to be inconvenienced.
Yeah, I think that's
no matter
right.
Who it is.
I think that's right. I think that to dump this somehow on the Trump White House is silly. Right.
Look, the Secret Service has one job, as Andre said. It's to protect the president, and it doesn't matter whether the president's Democrat or Republican. There was going to be huge security at that event anyway, but the Secret Service had control of the magnetometers and getting in there. And I didn't go to the game, but from those that I talked to that did, they weren't real happy about the hour and a half
well,
wait in the rain.
I just want to, for personal preference here, I just want to say that for me, one of the most exciting parts of the night was the fact that Kendrick Lamar did not perform inside the stadium, but was out in Centennial Olympic Park, where it was an electrifying performance. Not one of his greatest concerts, but what an exciting thing to have him out there on stage, in that extraordinary stage out there. Go back and watch it on YouTube. It was a lot of fun. Oprah Winfrey. Let's listen to a little bit of what Oprah Winfrey said in her speech, which has obviously gone totally viral this week, at the Golden Globes the other night.
In my career, what I've always tried my best to do, whether on television or through film, is to say something about how men and women really behave, to say how we experience shame, how we love and how we rage, how we fail, how we retreat, persevere, and how we overcome. And I've interviewed and portrayed people who've withstood some of the ugliest things life can throw at you, but the one quality all of them seem to share is an ability to maintain hope for a brighter morning, even during our darkest nights. So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight.
So, Greg, I couldn't help but think, as I listened to Oprah Winfrey give that speech, I couldn't help but go back to the Trump inaugural speech, which was such a dark vision of America. America, the American dream is dead. We've failed. I don't know. Who knows whether Oprah Winfrey herself really might run for president or not. But she did suggest a path by which you might oppose a President Trump. A dream of an America united with hope, inspired by its heroes. I think the Democrats are going to learn a lot from that speech.
It could have just been message testing on a national stage. And it sounded a lot like, honestly, what President Obama, some of his hope change rhetoric.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things, you know, that was interesting, I mean, I thought the speech was amazing and I thought it was apt for the moment in which it was being given, and she kind of rose to the occasion and spoke to that. I would expect no less of Oprah. The thing that worries me about this is that if we talk about, you know, rapturous change and hope and all of those things, it still has to be met with a program. And I think the hard thing that we are having as a society is that we get really drawn to charismatic figures who promise some type of nebulous change, but really have no way of knowing how to deliver on that. And so the same way that I have a problem with Donald Trump offering it, I have to be skeptical of Oprah or Mark Cuban or Mark Zuckerberg or anybody else who doesn't know what the heck they're doing.
I think that's
purporting to be president.
I think that Andrew makes a great point, which is why I said, who knows if she runs or not. We might be in a position where we're failing just as badly if we take a positive, charismatic leader as our next president, too. I think that's an excellent point.
She makes a great point, and the reality is, not only is that true, but the voters want right now an outsider. They like that. They like the idea of somebody that's not been in politics, that's not run for office. When I look at the stable of candidates that Democrats have that are looking at running, you know, they all look like the 15 candidates sans one that we had last time. And so I listened to Oprah's speech and I said, oh, she's running. If she's not running, she's looking to create or serve as a voice to some type of movement for another outsider to get in. And if the Democrats can do that, watch out. It could be a fascinating year next
right.
years.
We're out of time. My only closing point would be, I think that the reaction to the speech says that Americans are hungry for someone who presents a vision of who we can be at our best. That's the one thing. Now, what else comes with that is every bit as important. Greg Bluestein, Andrew Gillespie, Chip Lake, thank you so much for being here. Producer Tom Faust, producer Olivia Rheingold, who's also running our board. She's an engineer. Thank you both for your contributions to today's show. I'm Bill Nigut. Remember, tomorrow a special edition of Political Rewind, live at 2 o'clock. We'll preempt Two-Way Street. Greg Bluestein, Jim Galloway, and I will be at the state capitol, where we'll give you a live show about the governor's State of the State speech. Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, Speaker David Ralston, and others will be joining us to talk about their agendas for the session ahead. So we will see you tomorrow at 2. Thanks for being with us this afternoon.